The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, November 26, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks, but forgive me. I don't know that I've ever done this. I feel like in some way I'm cheating on all of you.
Please.
Yeah, I'm not wearing a soft collared shirt. I mean, it is sort of a soft collared shirt, but it's...
What, because of just years and years of washing it?
Yeah, exactly.
You can make something soft collar if you wear it enough.
I don't know what your point you're making, but I do know what your point you're making. Yes, it's not a soft collared shirt, but nevertheless, folks, it is one of our special, famous... post-Thanksgiving shows. And on the program today, we are delivering you two interviews. Emma, why don't you tell the folks what interview you did?
Well, I hope you all had a lovely Thanksgiving.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Yeah. Happy Thanksgiving.
I mean, I care about you, unlike somebody else. Yeah. Damn.
Oh, I get it. Sorry.
I hope your life is beautiful. Some other people's. Don't consider the audience. Regardless, I spoke with James North a while back, so you'll notice that some of the facts in this are a little behind the current news cycle. But I wanted to bring this to you because a lot of IMers, people have asked us about how much we're going to be covering the Donziger case. I did around a half-hour interview with James North about Donziger, the entire background of his case, why it's so egregious, and why it's so important that we pay attention.
And we should say he's in prison right now, and he's going to be there for another 5 months, I think, at this point.
Was conducted before he went to prison, so I just want people to be clear about that. But everything else is incredibly relevant, and I want people's understanding about what he's going through to be elevated for sure.
In 2019, there was a report that... found that national park employees felt abused and harassed. The agency never released it. This is the interview I did with David Troyer, who is the author of, a well-known author, but he wrote a piece a while back in The Atlantic called Return the National Parks to the Tribes. He is an Ojibwe author and historian. And, you know, one of the things that I've been concerned about for a long time is the potential of the right wing to privatize a lot of our national parks. Mm. They have been trying to do this for an extended period of time. And I am not, and I think there was, you know, attempts to do this under the Trump administration. But Troyer has a proposal, which, I mean... just struck me as so obvious. This is also an interview that we did ways back. So, it's a proposal that is just as relevant today as and probably sadly tomorrow as it was yesterday. So, I thought it might be appropriate and around Thanksgiving, which, you know, I think we've imparted a decent meaning to Thanksgiving these days, but the reality of Thanksgiving was probably a lot more gruesome than we perceive it as today. So I think you're going to enjoy that interview. In the meantime, today, as you know, is Black Friday. Well, for the next 5 or 6 days till December 1st, SunsetLakeSabaday.com and the Majority Report are teaming up to turn this day, the consumerist, I don't know what you would call it, frenzy into a fundraising opportunity for a great organization. And here's the deal. You visit sunsetlakesabadet.com. All Sabadet products are going to be between 30 and 60% off. You heard me right. 30 and 60% off. Orders over $100 are going to receive a free jar of delicious Sabadet gummies.
Oh,
they're
my God,
a $40 value.
So good.
A $40 value for free. So if you go buy $100 worth of stuff, what you're actually buying, and I'm going to screw up the math here. If it's 60% off and $100, you're buying like $210 or $220 worth of stuff for $100. Plus, you're getting another $40 worth of value. I mean, you're talking about almost like $300 for $100 worth of value. And everybody knows how these products. Matt loves the smokables. I got to be honest, I have a pre-roll every now and then. But the tinctures, the lotions, the fudge, the coffee, I mean, all great products. But for me, the thing that makes me so proud about our partnership with SunsetLakeSabadet.com is stuff like this. And they came to us with this idea. SunsetLakeSabadet.com is going to donate 10% of the sales for everything for over the course of these 2 weeks, ending December 1st, to givedirectly.org. It's an international anti-poverty organization that sends cash directly to folks to choose for themselves how to spend the money, gives them the dignity, and it best suits their lives because they can figure it out the most. Jewelry Report is going to match that 10% donation, regardless of how much it is. SunsetLakeSabadet.com is a majority employee-owned business. They have donated more than $16,000 this year to anti-drug war organizations, to animal shelters, union strike funds, nature conservation, food shelves, and refugee resettlement organizations. Great organization, great idea for this. This is honestly why I appreciate them as a sponsor. They came to us with this idea. Again, visit SunsetLakeSabadet.com. Take advantage of these discounts and help Majority Report raise money for a great organization. Sale ends December 1st. Also, not quite the same, anti-consumerist thing, but this is a great gift. This is a great gift for folks for Christmas, and it's a gift that keeps on giving. Say it.
Hello Tushy.
Bingo. The Hello Tushy bidet checks all the boxes. It's useful, but definitely unique. It is high tech, but definitely affordable. Plus, it's eco-friendly. So if you really want to give your friends and family something that is memorable this holiday, it is a Hello Tushy bidet. Hello Tushy bidet cleans your butt way better than just wiping. Cuts toilet paper use by 80%. Washes your bum with a fresh stream of water for a better clean. You just spray and pat dry. You don't need a plumber. You don't need an electrician. Hello Tushy conveniently attaches to your toilet in under 8 minutes. If you can change out your toilet seat, the complete Tushy system turns your restroom into the best room with a Tushy bidet attachment, an ottoman, toilet brush, and a Tushy stand and tissues. You can join the millions of happy butts falling in love with Hello Tushy. Folks, a lot of folks out there are bidet curious, as I call it.
Mm-hmm.
What better way for folks to, scratch that itch?
Get over the hump.
I don't want to say that. Get over the hump.
Get over the rump.
Get over the rump. What would you say? Like, what is, fulfill that?
You missed my pun.
Yeah, no, I got it. I got it.
It's trying to be in the spirit of the ad.
Fill the void?
Fill the void. No, I don't want to say, like, you know, when you're bidet curious, you can finally try. But that's what a gift is great. And it's far less expensive than you would imagine for a bidet. This is the time to do it. Give it to your folks. Give it to your friends. Give it to your family. Your siblings.
Suck it and see is the phrase that I think they use in marketing, but I don't think that's what we want to apply here.
I don't
a
even
bidet
know.
For your bedonk. How about that?
I feel like we're probably going to get you know, pulled down because of that one. Give the gift of a clean bum to yourself or your loved ones this holiday season. Get 10% off plus free shipping right now. HelloTushy.com/majority. That's HelloTushy.com/majority for 10% off and free shipping. Don't forget to tag at HelloTushy on social to celebrate your clean bum. Folks, don't forget, January 16th.
The big live. It's getting more natural. I know. It's really funny.
Get your tickets to the Majority Report Live right now at majoritylive.com or majorityreportlive.com. Doesn't matter. Majoritylive.com. Get your tickets for our big show. We will be back live on Monday. And now for those, first off, we'll hear from David Troyer, author of Return the National Parks to the Tribes. And with this proposal, and then Emma will be talking to
James North.
All right. And then we'll see you live on Monday. So we are living in an era where, we are starting as a nation, at least in some corners, to reconsider our history in this country in many respects. We've seen a resurgence of a corrective perspective on Reconstruction and the Civil War in many respects, as we see statues being pulled down across the country. But another thing that we're also doing, I think, or I hope at least, is also beginning the process, at least at arm's length in some respects, to reckon with our past when it comes to the indigenous people who lived in this country before white people did, and before it was, in fact, the country of America. And joining me now is David Troyer. He is the author of The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the present. He is also a Ojibwe from the Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota. David, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So you've written a piece in The Atlantic which calls for the returning of national parks to indigenous tribes across the country. What... I guess let's start with just because it really is in many respects a travel log, or unfortunately because of COVID, a non fully exercised travel log, but a travel log through also the history of the development of these parks and how they exist or why they exist. What was that your intention when you had planned to visit these parks?
Was it my intention to come up with this, what I think of as a very reasonable and modest proposal to...
what was the intention of visiting these parks, I guess? You know, just the... I mean, I imagine the proposal... Or was it, about the proposal?
Well, I mean, you know, the Atlantic Monthly, where the article was published, is engaged in a sort of multi... episode, if you will, retrospective on, you know, the magazine itself is, I think, over a number of months going to be looking back on and thinking through both, you know, what America, you know, has been, what it means, and where it's going. And so they asked me to write this article about national parks. And so I did, or I intended to. And, but you have to understand, you know, I'm traveling around the West going from park to park in the summer of 2020. You know, in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, in my home state, during sort of the worst of the spikes of COVID. And so I'm traveling around in my car across the country, and I'm really thinking very hard this whole time about, well, what does this country mean? How can it move forward? What does it need to do? You know, there is a broad and pointed and passionate engagement, as you put it, with the past. America is sort of engaged in a deep reckoning. And so as I'm researching and writing about the parks, it occurred to me that the national parks were established roughly at the same time that the government tried to disestablish Indian reservations through the passage of the General Allotment Act in 1886 or 87. So after the passage of that act, over 90 million acres were removed from Native control through through nefarious means. At the same time, the national parks were established and 87 million acres were brought into the national parks and national monuments across this country. And I thought, well, the national parks have been called America's best idea by Ken Burns, but I think there's a better idea out there. Return the parks to a consortium of tribes to manage on behalf of all Americans. And I think that would do a lot of important work, not only in terms of restitution to Native people, but I think it would be really good for parks too.
And also, and I would add, and I want to circle back to this part of the conversation. I think it would also be good for just the country as a whole. I mean, not just in the material benefit. I think that would come from having the parks protected by people who have a relationship with these parks that is that deep and caring. Because we've seen there are moves on the right and there was some attempts, I think, during the Trump administration, but certainly it's been floating out there to privatize these places and to commercialize them. But beyond that, I think also, you know, the idea of some type of restitution is healthy for the entire society, not just beneficial for those who are being restituted. It's not maybe not necessarily enough, but it is, I think, a change in consciousness that would be important. Yeah.
I mean, you know, speaking of sort of conservative movements, I mean, I think we have to reach back to Ronald Reagan, you know, and Reagan did many things, many of them bad. And one of the things that he did was he made the a lack of compassion acceptable in American society. You know, that's one of the major side effects of you know, Reagan's brand of republicanism and conservatism. You know, so like, you know, it would be nice, you know, as you put it a little bit earlier, it would be nice, for example, to go to Yosemite and gaze up at sort of the amazing views of El Capitan and Half Dome and places like that, and to see not just the mountain, but to know that you're standing there on, once again, Native land. And the fact that you can stand there and look at that place, you're looking not just at a mountain, but you're looking at a process of justice. It would be nice, as Camus put it, to be able to love justice and still love my country. And by returning the parks, that would be one way to do that. It would mean something completely else. You'd be gazing up at those rocks, at these beautiful views, and you'd be standing on land that you know was returned because there is a debt that is owed. You'd know that you live still, or once again, in a country that privileges justice and does, as Churchill put it, the right thing, but only after it's tried everything else.
And I would also say, and again, like I wanted to circle back on this, but there is a disconnection of history. I mean, we have a country that as a country is quite young. There's, you know, if you go to a place where, you know, a street or you're in a house that is 300 years old, you have, you know, at least in terms of the post-colonization is old. To have the ability to go to a place and not have to have this sort of break in history, because that is what fascinates me, is that what you've written here in this piece is just, it was all new to me. I mean, part of it was just simply, I just accept the national parks exist. I don't really question about it. I contemplate the idea. I'll take my kids. We'll see a nice view. But to go to these places now, there needs to be, for the most part, a process of disconnecting from the history of the place, that it needs to be seen as if it's in a, you know, completely without context, because we have, as an American nation, had to sort of erase some of these things because it might be because we've gone through no process of reconciling them.
Right. You know, and that's one of the biggest, I think, problems in this country is that we keep getting stuck. We keep getting stuck in these sort of cycles of, you know, violence or disenfranchisement, you know, and one of the reasons why I think we're stuck as a society, as a culture, is that we haven't engaged with, you know, the past, and we move forward into the future in our daily lives without any real appreciation for it, you know? And I think it's incredibly necessary, you know? And, you know, our parks, we like to think of the nature that they include as somehow outside of the human. But those places, you know, that's where history has happened. And so I think we need to reconcile ourselves to it, to see it more clearly, to sort of embrace it, and to recognize the ways that history is a force that, you know, isn't something that just happened in the past. History is a force that lives through us, you know, to this day.
Let's talk about some of the specifics around some of the parks. And also, earlier this week, I think it was maybe this week or last week, Rick Santorum was at some type of event and had, I haven't memorized the quote, but it just has popped into my head that he basically said, like, well, you know, we really don't have any Native American culture in our culture today.
Right.
Which was, I think, a prime example of this sort of like failure of history and understanding. You know, and I obviously was aware of, I think like the reason why we have corn, frankly.
More importantly, and this is for Mr. Santorum. I'm not really known to be the brightest bulb out there, but, you know, so a little history lesson for him in particular. Not only is Native American culture sort of a part of and sort of related to American culture, but the very government in which he exists is based on a Native model. Like, he probably doesn't know this, but for example, yeah, exactly. So after the American Revolution, when they're looking around for a new form of government, how are we going to organize ourselves? They look to the Iroquois Confederacy, and it's on them that the separation of powers is based, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. So Rick, you know, I've got a memo for you. The first part of which is just maybe read my book. Second part is maybe don't open your mouth.
Right. And, but we also, I mean, you made a, I thought it was very poignant, and this was a problem, not just for, former, Republican senators from Pennsylvania and, now CNN contributors, but also even at the, as early, I guess, as the mid to late 1800s, when people were coming upon these spaces and ostensibly going out there not to just explore, but to basically kill indigenous people to clear the land. There was this. You write that, and I think this is specifically about the soldiers who were sent to essentially kill the Miwok. I'm pronouncing it right, at Yosemite, that this is a vast untouched land. And, nature has grown this, but completely ignoring that the flora and fauna that exists there was a function of indigenous people spending thousands of years cultivating what would thrive there.
Exactly so, you know, but so one of America loves to tell itself stories about itself, you know, most of which are untrue, you know, and those stories and those myths are in service of a kind of, you know, are basically hitched up to this sort of imperialist, colonialist expansion and maintenance, you know, of the republic. One of the stories that America has always told itself is that people came here and they were greeted by a vast and beautiful and savage land empty of people. And it needed to be conceptually empty of people so that you could then, you know, you could then have it. And it was, there was no taking. There was just a having, you know. And so You know, when people came to the East Coast, where I think you are right now, they saw these beautiful, you know, old growth forests and these majestic trees. And they thought, how wonderful, how beautiful. But of course, those forests looked the way they did because tribes up and down the Eastern Seaboard, you know, managed those forests and burnt undergrowth and did controlled burns to grow those trees and to grow forage for game that they wanted close by for as a food source. Buffalo is so named Buffalo, New York, because tribes had increased pasture and grassland by burning as far east as Buffalo, New York, to get bison to live there.
Will you add to that? I mean, there were the acorns and walnuts and give us a sense of like just what the numbers were. I mean, this stuff seems like it should be. Like everyone, American should understand this, you know, in grade five or four, frankly. But there's this massive chasm of where these myths have stood in the way of these basic understanding of the country that we live in. So give us a sense of just like what the numbers were, leading up until we get into the mid to late 1800s when these national parks were founded.
I mean, you know, just a brief sketch, you know, at the time of first contact, you know, various estimates place the population of North America, just North America, at around 15 million, you know. By 1890, there were, according to the census, less than 250,000 native people left, you know. So there was a massive Holocaust that stretched for centuries. And it wasn't merely, by the way, a matter of just, oh, native people, you know, weren't immune to European diseases. You know, Europeans weren't immune to the plague. They got the plague. Over half the population of Europe died, but those populations rebounded because Europeans didn't suffer under the yoke of colonialism in Europe after the plague. So the reason why our numbers plummeted was, yes, in part disease, but we were never able to rebound until now because of the continued threats to our food sources, our very lives, and so on. So by the time 1890, at the close of the frontier, that's when the frontier was declared officially closed. And once it was closed, people started making parks to sort of memorialize, you know, the natural past of this country. At that time, there were fewer than 250,000 native people left alive. But now there are over 5 million. And that's the other myth that America tells itself, that Native Americans have a great future behind us, you know,
right?
And that we actually aren't here anymore in any kind of real way. But I'm here to tell you that as of the last census and the new one, we will see there were over 5 million. There were more Native people in this country than there are people who identify as Jewish American in this country. And nearly twice as many Native people as those who define themselves as Muslim American. But you would never know that.
You would never know that. All right, we need to take a quick break. We'll be back with more in just a moment. So, David, in the last segment, we were going over like broad strokes, but also sort of the very compelling reasons that are behind the idea of essentially returning the national parks that we have to indigenous tribes of this country. We finished the last segment by your giving us some sense of the size of the genocide, the Holocaust that took place in the centuries leading up to the mid to late 1890s, 1890 when the frontier ended. And most of these national parks were established as a way of sort of like, this is like the museum of the frontier, and we're going to keep this pristine. And you know, good for us, we were able to we saved this untouched area from ourselves on some level, and that was a way of showing our humanity. Meanwhile, you refer to these as and in many respects as crime scenes. Because of what was done, because it was stolen land in, and involved either stealing and or just simply, genocide to appropriate these lands. Give us a sense. Let's talk about what park stands out for you as the most indicative of this dynamic, or is that question almost irrelevant insofar as it was it was such a wholesale and complete project that it's irrelevant to look at one?
Oh yeah, I don't know that the message can be served by just looking at one. I mean, the Mariposa Battalion marched into Yosemite Valley to kill Indians, you know, and succeeded in killing most and then removed the remainder. And then Yosemite National Park was made some couple decades later. You know, Yellowstone National Park was established in the 1870s during the peak of the Plains Wars between tribes and the U.S. government. The Custer's Last Stand, that battle was 2 years away, you know, when that park was made. Shoshone-Bannock people were forcibly excluded from living and hunting and gathering in what was Yellowstone National Park. Glacier National Park in the early part of the 20th century was carved out of Blackfeet homelands. You know, they were forced to concede and to relinquish title to those lands after a devastating winter in which a huge portion of the tribe died from starvation and disease in around 1910. You know, so you can't just look at one. Or the Grand Canyon, where the Supai still managed to live at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, but other tribes were removed and excluded and no longer live there. Tribes extant and still living today, like the Blackfeet, like the Miwok and others, you know. And the other thing in the article that I was trying to emphasize was that this wouldn't just be good for tribes. And this wouldn't just be a good way for America to practice some sort of to keep, you know, the practice of justice alive in some way. This would be really good for parks. Parks are suffering. Parks are definitely suffering from a lack of leadership, from overcrowding, from failing to react to climate change, from a kind of relinquishing of the sort of the scientific mission of parks. Also, parks suffer because of federal policy. Obama greatly enlarged Bears Ears National Monument and added millions of acres to its holdings. 2 weeks after Trump took office, he slashed Bears Ears by 80%. And why did he do this? Only because he was pissed off at the National Park Service for reporting the real numbers of the people who attended his inauguration.
Right.
His first Twitter fight in office was with the National Park Service. So for all those reasons, wouldn't it be better to give the parks to a consortium of tribes to manage on behalf of all Americans, where it would be protected from the whims of this or that president and this or that funding cycle, you know, and for whom sort of, you know, we have long and deep experience of administering to widely scattered land holdings. We know how to administer to the kinds of lands that would be in that gift. So it would be good for parks. It would be good for Americans, period.
And we should say that you your idea includes the transfer subject to covenants, guaranteeing the use of the parks are, you know, substantially, well, at least you say at least as stringent as the park rules that exist today. So you touch on this and I want to talk about this aspect with the MHA nation, otherwise known as the Three Affiliated Tribes. And there is this tension. They have, in the same way that indigenous people have the ability to sort of live slightly outside of our system or within it, but that there you can have casinos, you can have leases, oil leases in this instance. that relationship and that tension of the extraction, that the only way for the MHA to build some type of base of commerce or of you know being able to provide for the people in the tribe is to extract from the land in a way that is in tension with the the you know tribal ways on some level. I mean, can you talk about that that piece, that part of your piece?
Sure. You know, the three affiliated tribes, you know, are, you know, their land holdings, you know, are on top of some very rich, oil rich lands, you know, and sort of like tribes around the country, you know, for whom sort of economic development has always been a struggle, for various reasons, many of them geographic, some of them governmental. You know, many tribes have had to wrestle over, you know, long periods of time around sort of to what degree do we exploit and extract, you know, mineral resource sources for one. So MHA have to grapple with oil and oil development. You know, the Navajo Nation has had to grapple with, you know, to what extent do we mine for coal and uranium? So, you know, we, like this country itself, have long had to wrestle with, you know, commercial impulses. We need to develop resources to survive, just like everyone else. And, you know, a better, more conservationist understanding. You know, the fact that MHA sort of exploits oil, or at least, you know, that was an emphasis of their former tribal government under Tex Hall, isn't sort of a referendum on Native leadership, you know? But the fact that they've had to wrestle with this puts them and other tribes in a great place to sort of manage parks. The motto of the national park system is not come see nature. You know, the motto of the national park system is the land of many uses. You know, parks are themselves, to this day, they're not preserved in amber. You know, there's logging, there's all these considerations, like to what extent do we allow motorized vehicles? You know, parks have always wrestled with the same tension that tribes have always wrestled with, too. You know, so I think that makes us perfectly suited for the job, frankly.
So as a skill set, there is I would argue there hasn't been enough wrestling as a nation with that type of extraction, to be honest with you, that there is a, you know, my sense is that, indigenous folk have a, there's more ambivalence about something like that than there has been. You know, this country was founded on some level on extraction, and it certainly survived. I mean, the to the extent that we have had any type of wrestling that's going on, you know, one person in that ring is a lot weaker than the other in that fight. Let me just ask you this. I mean, where do you feel like is this? How widely contemplated is this idea?
It's hard for me to say. All I know is the sort of feedback I get from my socials. But again, that could just be a very, very, you know, tidy and closed loop.
But has this been an idea that has been like sort of talked about in indigenous circles? Is this something that people are looking to maybe Deb Haaland, the first Native American member of cabinet? I mean, is this idea, has it had any life or have you just birthed it essentially?
From what I can tell, I think I've birthed it to, you know, for whatever that's worth. You know, I mean, when I was traveling around the country and I'm talking to park people and I'm talking to Native people and I'm talking to Native park people and I'm talking to all sorts of people, I'm like, hey, what would you think? How would this go? You know, and everyone I talk to, at least the Native folk I talk to, they're like, that's a great idea. Yep, we could do this. As far as Secretary Haaland, I don't know what she's thinking, you know, but, you know,
what
this
was
is a country, this is a country that is sort of, it's always sort of, you know, founded on the notion that we have good ideas. Well, you know, as a Native person and as an American, this is my good idea.
What was the response from people? I mean, I spoke to you talked to people who work at the parks, and you made a point of saying that they all, that the you know, park service people who work at these parks have, well, it's a fairly unique and not just governmental job. It's a fairly unique job where you have that many people talking about how much they love, you know, where they work and why they work. I mean, this is, but what was their reaction to something like this?
Well, it was mixed, you know, and I have to say, just, you know, from a journalistic viewpoint, you know, the majority of the park people I talked to played it pretty close to their vest. And one person told me that, oh yeah, you know, everyone in the park service up to the very top knows you're writing this article and they're very nervous, said one person. I said, why nervous? From little old me? Like, well, A, you're not little and neither is the Atlantic. And you know, the park service was suffering under Trump. They were very nervous about what Trump might or might not do. And so, like, you know, honestly, not very forthcoming in my interviews with them. And I understand why, because they were worried about the parks. Like, what if Trump had gotten reelected?
Right.
And they put something out there that he didn't like, you know, I mean, he's so venal and so small, like he could make some huge executive decision, you know, vis-a-vis parks, because he didn't like something someone said in a magazine. So they were very cautious, but, you know, but they are generally, like, if I can make a generalization, you know, the park people I did talk to were passionate, thoughtful, and interested in doing whatever is best
for the park.
You know, that they did they agree with me wholeheartedly? Probably not, you know, but they want to do what's best by sort of both the parks and the people who need them. So they were open-minded.
It just occurred to me you were writing this while Trump was president.
I was.
As opposed to having written it over the past. Interesting. Well, I honestly, it seems like such, it had never occurred to me, but it seems like such an obvious idea, such an obviously good idea at this point. I can't encourage people enough to read your piece in The Atlantic, because it really makes the point well. David Troyer, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. And yeah, when you can, go visit the parks. They're beautiful.
I'm going to try. let's hope.
Take care.
Human rights lawyer Stephen Donziger was just sentenced to 6 months in federal prison after already spending nearly 800 days under house arrest. And so he must have done something awful then, right? You know, this must have just been a part of normal criminal justice procedures, and it's definitely not abnormal. Well, not so much. In fact, it's such an outrageous instance of injustice that the United Nations condemned it. And yet the 6 month sentence was still handed down. Here to talk about all of this and more is James North, independent writer, author of Freedom Rising, and editor at large at Mondo Weiss, whose piece on this in The Nation is entitled "Is Chevron's Vendetta Against Stephen Donziger Finally Backfiring?" Welcome to the show, James.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Thanks so much for being here. So for people who may not know, just please tell the audience about Stephen Donziger's case.
There is no short answer to this. It is an extraordinarily complicated. I've been active in progressive causes for 50 years, and I would have to say that what I've seen in the case of Stephen Donziger and Chevron's vendetta against them is one of the worst and most surprising and shocking things that I've seen in my long life of reporting on this type of thing. I came to this story close to 10 years ago. Stephen has been pursuing this case for environmental justice for 30 years, nearly 30 years, in Ecuador, where there's an area of rainforest the size of the state of Rhode Island that was polluted by Texaco, a predecessor company to Chevron, which dumped oil wastes there back in the 70s and 80s. I came to this area before I even met Stephen Donziger. I'm Spanish speaking. My wife is from Ecuador. And so I'm familiar with the way the country works. I went there in, I think, 2011 or 2012, and I saw firsthand the pollution. I saw oily wastes. I saw, you know, people complaining about elevated levels of cancer. And so having seen this firsthand, I decided to do something about it. So I started writing about it. And The Nation magazine, to its credit, has published my articles on this subject many, many times. Basically, what happened is the case began with local grassroots people in Ecuador complaining about the environmental pollution that was affecting them and their health and their area. They organized, and then they connected with lawyers in Ecuador, who in turn connected with a young, as he was then, Harvard Law School graduate, Stephen Donziger, who started representing them. To try and summarize quickly, the case started in New York federal courts. Through the 90s, it was pursued there. In 2001, I believe, the decision was made to send the case to Ecuador. I believe that Chevron, which had taken over Texaco in 2001, believed that they could have a better chance to win in Ecuador. The case started up again in Ecuador in 2003, and in 2009, Donziger, his allies, and his 30,000 plaintiffs, his clients actually, won a landmark decision, $9.5 billion, to clean up the environment and to build hospitals which don't exist in this area for the increasing number of cancer victims. $9.5 billion sounds like a lot of money, but when you compare it to the amount of money that BP had to put forward after they polluted the Gulf of Mexico in 2010, it doesn't sound like quite so much. Chevron, which had participated in all stages of the judicial hearings in Ecuador, then came up with a new strategy starting in about 2010. They came back to the United States, went into federal court, and attacked Donziger and his allies on the grounds of they used what's called the RICO Act, which was originally designed to pursue the mafia. And they charged him and his allies with corruption, with fraud, and with bribery. And a trial ensued there, which lasted 3 or 4 years. And in the end, they were found not technically guilty of a crime, but civilly liable for. In other words, Chevron used its vast wealth to fly up witnesses from Florida. Their key witness, very suspect individual. He was a judge who had lost his position. Chevron paid for him to, an Ecuadorian, paid for him to move to the United States, moved his entire family. And then basically he testified in court that Donziger and Donziger's Ecuadorian allies had offered him a $500,000 bribe to throw the case, and B, even though he wasn't the judge of record, and B had basically had, they offered him money to also ghostwrite the decision, which they said wasn't written by the real Ecuadorian judge. So anyway, see, I'm getting out of breath by explaining this all.
Yes,
to you.
It gets more
unbelievable. Oh yes, it's just appalling.
Yeah.
Then what happened was they lost, and basically an ensuing case, a case of contempt. Chevron went after Donziger further and said that he had not turned over certain recordings, certain of his electronic equipment that Chevron wanted, which they had a right to because they'd won the case. Donziger resisted, saying that if Chevron got a hold of his recordings, that would violate attorney-client privilege. The oil giant would be able to understand what strategies they were planning. He declined politely. Judge Kaplan, who was the original judge here, asked the attorney for the Southern District of New York to prosecute Donziger for contempt. The attorney said no. The prosecutor, I should say no. And then Kaplan did a totally unprecedented step of picking a private lawyer to conduct a prosecution supposedly on behalf of the U.S. government. That continued, but it gets worse. Basically, what happened was Donziger has been held under house arrest in his New York apartment for over 2 years. What this means is there's an ankle bracelet attached to his ankle. He has to apply 48 hours in advance to be able to leave the house to go anywhere. He's basically been confined there. And the judge in this case, one Judge Preska, justified this on the grounds that he was a flight risk. Now, here's a man whose passport had been removed. He has a wife and a teenage son in New York. Meanwhile, the guy who was eventually convicted of killing George Floyd in Minneapolis, he was allowed out on bail, waiting trial, while Stephen Donczik was confined to his apartment for most of the time. Okay. Then what finally happened was there was a trial, again, without a jury. See, I want to emphasize a key factor here is that Donziger has been punished severely, and he has never once faced a trial, traced the jury of his peers. He's been convicted by one judge and then convicted by another judge. No jurors, due to the way the law works, have been allowed to decide his fate here. Never once, not once. He was just convicted last Friday. I guess it was 6 days ago now, and sentenced to 6 months in federal prison, which is the highest penalty that you can get for this kind of contempt. And in doing so, sentencing, Judge Preska, to my astonishment, again, I've been following this case for nearly 10 years, she said that Stephen, I'm paraphrasing now, the exact quote is in my article, but she said that Stephen Donziger does not have a respect for the law, and the only way that he would be taught a respect for the law is if you hit him with the proverbial 2x4 right between the eyes. Now,
that's what this is about. This is about discipline, right?
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Now the point, so in other words, there his family and supporters are sitting there and having to listen to Stephen being described as somebody who's like a mule, a recalcitrant mule who has to be hit with a piece of wood before he respects the law. I mean, it sounds amusing, but it's not amusing. It's really disgusting. He is a political prisoner. There's no question about it. So anyway, that's a short version of what actually happened. You can see my articles in The Nation have to go on at great length just to get in all the backstory so that people can kind of follow what's going on. And I haven't even touched upon, and I won't, the disbarment. You know,
well, we have some time. I'd love to touch on it, but I want to emphasize a shift that I think is so unbelievable in how this was clearly a civil proceeding, and right, it became a criminal treatment. Not that Donziger is even a criminal. He's an attorney representing people who have been wronged, and Chevron went after him with immense persistence because he was not playing by their rules, essentially. How did that transition even happen? Because that's incredibly unusual for people who are unfamiliar with these dynamics.
Absolutely. What happened is that Chevron has almost unlimited resources, and Donziger and his allies estimate that they've spent $2 billion pursuing him. Multiple law firms, discovery, efforts to go here, efforts to go there. I have asked Chevron, you know, every time I do an article, I email their publicity department. And that first they used to answer me, which I was fine. I put their responses in the articles. Now they basically just decided that they don't want to answer me. So they will not estimate how much they've spent on this case. But, you know, I guess if you have enough lawyers and enough time and enough resources to fly people around and to bring witnesses up from Ecuador who you've already in effect paid off, I guess you can turn what should have been, you're right, a civil proceeding into a criminal proceeding. And basically they said years ago, before this even got fully underway, our goal is to demonize Donziger. In other words, we want to discredit this case, and get away with not having to pay what we owe. Let me just add parenthetically too, Chevron has tried to insinuate that Donziger is after it for the money. You know, and any of these type of cases, the attorney that brings the case is awarded in the, you know, they do it without getting any payment ahead of time.
It's also projection. They're doing it for money. Yes.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. Absolutely. So basically they've insinuated that he's after it for money. The response to that is very clear. He has been losing in courtrooms for 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years now. If he were only after money, he would have dropped this case back in 2010, 11, 12, 13, 14, and gone on and used his Harvard Law School diploma to find you know, a new money making opportunity. He's not in it for the money. He's a 60-year-old man now. He's very well respected. I know his clients. I've met them and I talk to them on the phone regularly. He's very well respected, and they regard him as a hero, which in fact he is. And as a result, another point that I want to make here is that the mainstream press has been woefully inadequate in this. The New York Times has not had a single story on this. Basically, there was a brief one about 6 months ago, but has not covered it in any details for like 6 or 7 years. Here's a guy in the Times' hometown, New York, who's been under house arrest, who has now been convicted and will be sent, you know, if their appeals are going on, but could be sent to federal prison. You know, they have reporters in South America who could go to the rainforest and talk to and find out what's actually going on there. And yet they haven't done a single report. I really don't understand it. Thankfully, programs like yours and other alternative media are actually looking into this. And there has been a huge growth in interest in this case, even in the last year or so. More and more people are following it. More and more people are outraged by it. You mentioned that the United Nations has taken, you know, has issued a, you know, a very disturbing, condemning the two judges involved. But behind all this, I want to emphasize is Chevron, this giant oil corporation. This is the problem. They have unlimited resources, and basically, what I would like to know is, what do their shareholders think about this? This is starting to tarnish their reputation. Now, I live in New York, where we don't have Chevron gas stations here, but if you live in the South or certainly in California, you know, every other gas station is either a Chevron or a Texaco. What is it going to do to their business if they continue to be seen more and more as to, you know, demonizing and persecuting this human rights lawyer? I mean, it just, they're not thinking straight over there. I guess that's the way I would put it.
Yeah, it's become personal. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about how the United Nations may have turned the public relations about this in a significant way as paired with his sentencing. And I also want to talk about Judge Kaplan and his role in this, which is quite shady. We'll be right back. So we touched on it a little, but the United Nations speaking out about this is, I think, quite important because it contrasts how the American judicial system has approached this case with Donziger and how, frankly, there is an immense level of arrogance with a lot of the way that people in the judicial system, judges themselves, portray themselves in the United States almost like priests. We see this with the Supreme Court as well. And there is a ton of right-wing and corporate influence in our judicial system. And it doesn't matter if you're not nominated by a Republican, those factors are still there. So having that outside perspective, having the United Nations say something like this, I think it makes that contrast even more stark.
Well, I agree entirely. And it's not just the United Nations. I mean, I don't have the latest figures right in front of me, but I believe it's 45, 50, 60 Nobel Prize winners have come out defending Stephen Donziger, including some who have won the Peace Prize. I mean, human rights lawyers all over the world, hundreds of them have come out. Number of well-known celebrities and activists have come out and basically said that he's being treated terribly here. You're absolutely right. I think, you know, what's happened to the judicial system is that over the last 20, 30 years, when I was growing up, I'm not a lawyer, thankfully, but when I was raised, there was a certain amount of respect for federal judges. Often in civil rights cases, for instance, in the South, they were the lone voice of honesty and reason when it came to some of these, you know, to endorsing or approving some of the civil rights legislation and finding in faith. That's changed over time, particularly in the last 20 years or so. I mean, you cannot be a person who has progressive views, a progressive lawyer, and get on the federal bench these days, I don't think. Now, Judge Kaplan basically spent his entire life as a corporate lawyer until the early 90s when he was chosen to be a federal judge. He's respected for his knowledge of criminal procedure, but how this man feels that he could judge a case that took place in Ecuador, a country that, as far as I know, he's never been. He doesn't speak foreign languages. You know, you want somebody to judge who is familiar with the overall atmosphere and situation, not just the law, but the facts. Kaplan found against Stephen Danziger and his allies on the facts. He chose to believe these witnesses rather than the other witnesses. Now, I guarantee you, if you had had a jury of 12 New Yorkers who would have been in there, you know, some of them would have been Latinos, other they would have had a variety of life experience. They wouldn't have been Ecuadorians, but it still would have been, Danziger would never have been found guilty, never, okay? And the contempt case that he was just convicted of and could be sent to prison for six months, same thing going on there. The fact is that these are people, the federal judges lead an isolated life. The whole system.
They're cloistered. They're cloistered. Yes, and they exactly, also.
Exactly. The perfect word. The perfect
and they also word. Fetishize the American system, which create, not all, but many, the recent ones, which I think sometimes creates blind spots when, especially if you're ruling on a case that's international. And he shouldn't have been in a position to rule on said case because the Ecuadorian courts already exactly. handled this. And that's why this, like, this kind of procedure was important because right. keeping it within the confines of the Ecuadorian courts makes sense because they have an intimate understanding of exactly what precisely. Went down. Right.
Precisely. And in fact, Chevron, or as it was then, Texaco, they asked for the case to be sent back to Ecuador. They didn't want to be tried in New York. And then when they got to Ecuador, they discovered that the political climate had changed and that the sympathetic atmosphere that they thought they were going to get back in the 90s had changed. A progressive president had been elected, although he didn't interfere with the case or anything. And as a result, they didn't like what they were seeing. Well, they didn't pull out of the case. They appealed it through three layers of Ecuadorian courts. And only when they lost at the very highest level in Ecuador did they come and bring an entirely new case. I mean, it's absurd. You know, people don't believe me when I say that this is what happened. You know, you lose a case in one country and then you come and sue you counter sue the people in a different country. It's preposterous.
It certainly is preposterous. I guess now we can talk a little bit more about where Danziger goes from here. I understand that his lawyers are prepping an appeal, but given how stacked our courts are with very similar judges to Judge Kaplan and even more extreme, I would imagine that there's the thing that would probably be most effective is getting the word out so there's public pressure on some of these judges.
Not just public pressure on the judges. That's a very good point. But pressure on the Chevron Corporation. You know, they could come at any time and offer a settlement for this finding, this judgment against them in Ecuador. And that would be up to, not to Danziger, but to his clients in Ecuador to decide, you know, do we accept this or not accept this? And what the only thing that will force them to do that is if there is increasing pressure from the public, from large shareholders. For instance, in California, this giant investment fund called CalPERS, which is the retirement money for the California public employees. They're the teachers, you know, their retirement plan, the various other public employees. It's a huge institutional investor. It's progressive on some issues. Now, once these people get more and more aware, whoever's managing those funds and the people who are contributing to them, I mean, Chevron's headquartered in California. They don't want negative publicity. So the way around it, I think, is I would agree that you know, the judges may pay attention or not, but they do have lifetime appointments. But Chevron, you know, when I'm driving the next time I'm in California driving, you can, as I've already done, you can bet when I need to fill my rented car with gas, I'm not going to a Chevron station. More and more people do that, and the company continues to get, that will put the kind of pressure on them that could bring about a change in this case. It's going on forever, though. I mean, it's just extraordinary, and they keep at it.
Yeah, it really is unbelievable. I guess I also don't want to leave this story without emphasizing the impact on Ecuadorians and how many people were affected by the malfeasance of Chevron, then Texaco. Talk a little bit about why Danziger was in this fight and how many people were affected, how they were affected. And I think given what's happening in the news with oil spills on the weekly, it's something that should be emphasized.
No, I agree entirely. I mean, basically, I can't remember off the top of my head whether it's 5 or 6 peer-reviewed studies show a higher incidence of cancer in the area where these oil, they weren't spills. They were deliberately dumped into the environment. Yeah. Texaco violated, it wasn't an accident, okay? Texaco violated, had Texaco done the same thing, even in the state of Texas back in the 70s and 80s, it was against the law. And other things that they did were considered unethical, even if not strictly illegal. So there was deliberate dumping into an environment because there's just a lot of indigenous people, a lot of poor people in South America, and who cares what happens to them? And then when Texaco pulled out of there, they did a half-hearted cleanup of a little bit of the area and then just left it. So there's a higher incidence of cancer. But what you will see is I went on what's called the Toxie Tour, where they take you around to the various sites where Texaco had dumped. And my guide would plunge this corer-like device into the ground. You know, you would see, it looked like normal rainforest, but he would go down 3 feet, 4 feet, 5 feet, and then he would pull up oil-soaked dirt. You know, they can't drink water out of the streams. Like, they have to use purifying, which they, you know, it's too costly to do. Skin problems, all kinds of issues. And pretty much everywhere you go, somebody in that area, somebody in that extended family, you know, my uncle died of cancer. Oh, my niece came down with cancer. And we're not talking New York or Los Angeles or San Francisco here, where there are good hospitals fairly close by. To get treated for cancer in this rainforest region, you got to jump on a bus and go 8 hours to Quito or maybe 12 hours to Guayaquil. And they're reasonable cancer hospitals. But what also, let me just point out here, the settlement does not give checks to individual people in the rainforest. It doesn't say, okay, you suffered because you live here, so let's give you $200 or $700, whatever. It's to be an organization called the Amazon Defense Fund will use this money for the benefit of all of them to clean up the areas. There are ways that you can scour. It's been done in a couple of spots there. I saw it, where you can actually scour the earth, get rid of the oil pollution and clean it up. And then they'll construct hospitals or clinics or whatever to deal with the cancer, pay doctors reasonable amounts to come and work out there instead of, what they have now are very simple health posts, which are insufficient. So basically, yeah, the people who have really suffered here are the 30,000 people in Ecuador. And I still don't understand.
And they should get settlements. They should get financial settlements.
Exactly. But the point is, What Chevron and its allies have tried to do is portray Danziger and the people. They've tried to portray Danziger as a puppet master who's just interested in money, an ambulance chaser who found his way to the rainforest. And the local people in Ecuador is a bunch of ignorant people who don't know what's going on and who are being manipulated by him. Well, I can tell you, I'm good friends with Luis Llanza, who's the head of that, who's the elected president of the Amazon Defense Fund. And if anybody were to try to insinuate that Luis was a puppet of anybody, I mean, you would, in 30 seconds, he would convince you that that's not true. Danziger works for them, not the other way around. So I'm glad and again, I don't understand, why can't the New York Times and the Washington Post send their correspondent out there? It's a simple 45-minute plane flight from Quito. They could be there. They could go and find what's actually going on there and report about it. Instead, nothing.
Yeah. I mean, it's a question of will and also editorial choices. Right. And there, I think, is a deference to, again, not to harp on this point, but I keep thinking about it, the saintliness of judges. And if they are seeing this, then there must be something there, right?
You're right.
Yeah.
Especially when we're talking federal judges, because I think most people would understand, have an understanding that you can have a local corrupt municipal judge, but the federal bench, I mean, this is supposed to be an area of honesty and integrity. And there are, I could name you judges in the New York area who are outstanding. I mean, really, not because they agree with me, but because they're honest people. Okay. But unfortunately, the case did not get sent before one of them.
Yes, it really is devastating, but I really appreciate your time today. James North, independent writer, his book is called Freedom Rising. It's about South Africa, and you can read that as well. And he is the editor at large at Mondo Weiss, and you can read his work at The Nation, including this piece entitled Is Chevron's Vendetta Against Stephen Donziger Finally Backfiring? And hopefully the answer to that question is yes, soon enough.
Right.
Yes.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you for getting the word out there. I mean, people find what we've been talking about here, people really do find it hard to believe, but it's true.
It's true. Thanks so much, James. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.